God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Amen.
All right, the Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here tonight in your first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. Anybody? You raise your blue hand or wave at the screen. I'm going to scroll through. Anybody fit that first 30 days? Well, welcome if you're shy. Let's see. I'm going to share my screen and ask Leanne to please read the preamble. Need to unmute, Leanne.
Hey, everybody. My name's Leanne, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leanne.
AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, Leanne. Let's see. And so the format of this meeting tonight is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight we're excited to welcome Craig W. from Sandy Hook, Connecticut to tell his story. And after Craig shares, we'll take a break around the top of the hour, and we'll call for maybe a few announcements, pass the seven tradition basket, et cetera. And then we'll repeat the opportunity for you guys to send questions to the user questions. And then we'll reconvene and the last half hour of the meeting, we'll just be able to ask whatever questions come in. So we're delighted to have Craig come share with us tonight. I don't want to take up another minute of his time. Welcome, Craig W.
Thanks, David. Thanks, guys. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Craig. Honored to be here tonight. Privileged to be here tonight. Very grateful for the opportunity to have the time to share my experience, strength, and hope. And then I love the format of being able to ask questions. I think it's a great format. Sobriety date is 11/28/98. I've been separated from alcohol since then. I have a sponsor, and I also have a service sponsor. For those of you who are unfamiliar with service sponsorship, it's someone that guides you through the traditions, the concepts, the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then gives you some experience, strength, and hope as it's outlined in our conference structure. Lots of service in my story. I'll be happy to share some of that. And then, of course, I have the opportunity to sponsor and service sponsor, which is a blessing. I notice sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous these days, we kind of have a hierarchy with sponsorship. And I'm not about the hierarchy. In sobriety, I've lost children. Well, I'm sorry, not children. I've lost a child. I've lost jobs. I've moved. And it's the sponsees that keep me grounded. It's the sponsees that keep me sober. It's the sponsees that helps me to keep, you know, my relationship with my higher power growing and hopefully what I declare is strong. So I love the sponsees. They save me. I'm sure if you talk to some of my sponsees, they might tell you they look up to me or I saved your life or whatever. I would say the same thing about my sponsor. But I guess I'm just saying it's more of a shoulder-to-shoulder thing than it is a hierarchy. I do have a home group. It's a Tuesday night group. For as long as I've been sober, even when I was homeless in sobriety, which I'll talk about, I've had a home group. And I've had a service position in my home group. And I attended my group every week as much as humanly possible. It was very important. And of course, staying involved in service and attending the business meeting and knowing my peers was important. I like to talk. I love when there's an opportunity to talk for a little more than 15 to 20 minutes. Not that I need to or any of us do, but it really gives me the opportunity to really touch on the whole picture of, you know, what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. And I'm sure you guys listening to the individuals coming in and out of here enjoy that and then use that, that get to share, feel the same way. So, but my family has been devastated by alcoholism. Alcoholism has been in my family for as long as the stories I've heard and up until now, of course. The men, they were all alcoholic. They were either neglectful, not around, incarcerated, emotionally unavailable, there but not present. And the women were dealing with the neuroses of dealing with all this stuff. And you know, the way alcoholism worked in my family, and I'll just give you an idea, because I was around in the 80s, and for those of you who are similar to my age or understand the 80s, you didn't really talk about homosexuality or HIV. You just didn't talk about those things. And I had two uncles that were homosexual and had HIV. But I also had a grandmother that was taking her shirt off while she was drinking, and an aunt that was drinking. And those aren't even the big time alcoholics. And then we have men that were incarcerated, men that wouldn't show up for weeks. And we never talked about any of that, but we would talk about homosexuality and HIV all day long because we just didn't have the capacity to talk about alcoholism. I also come from a family where there's feuds, 30, 40 year old feuds, because one person can't just simply say, I'm wrong, or I apologize. And there's great division within the family, which really brings power to the 10th step, which we'll get into in a little bit. I mean, it's so simple. We hear it day in and day out, whether it's reading how it works or we do our own inventory, whatever, we just hear the 10th step over and over again. But to really understand how powerful it is for an alcoholic or an individual in an alcoholic family to admit they're wrong is just fascinating. And I'll share with you one of the wonderful gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. My wife is in Al-Anon. My mother is in Al-Anon. And my stepson, who's 11, is in Alateen. And we're all surrounded by the program. We're all involved in service. We sponsor, we have sponsors. We talk about the steps. We read each other's readings. We meditate together. And for Alcoholics Anonymous, I've served in many capacities, spoke at conventions, served as delegate, dealt with, you know, people from the Ukraine, Switzerland, like all this kind of cool stuff and cool stories. But one of the best things I've been able to do is sit on panels with my entire family and share experience rather than hope. And to have my son talk about breaking the cycle and me and my mom and my wife. And it's just, it's a powerful thing. It's amazing. And it says all throughout Big Book that recovery is met in the families too. Obviously it's not gender specific. I'm just quoting the words, but you know, the family gets to recover too. And how selfish is it for me to come to AA and get well and then not share that or not offer that? You know, I got to earn it a little. I got to get some trust back and whatnot. I don't want to just kick it in the door talking about how great AA is, but why wouldn't I share why it's so important? And I never really understood why my mom was so jealous at AA in the beginning. I came in at 19, so I didn't have a wife yet. But, you know, my mom was so jealous at AA. And I realized later on, here's a bunch of people in a church basement that are drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, and sharing experience with me. And I'm finally sober. But the 17 institutions I was in, the incarceration, the bloodiness, the fights, the missing, the this, the that, no matter how hard she tried, no matter what work she put in, she couldn't change me. So that's why it's so important to explain what's going on. One of the coolest things that ever happened to me one Christmas years ago after I was delegate, I had wrote an article about anonymity. And my aunt, who was in another program, she called me up after that and she said, hey, listen, I read your article on anonymity. I think it's wonderful. And the reason my aunt did that is because when I interact with my family, they know what I'm doing. They know what's going on in my home group. They meet some of my sponsees. I bring my sponsees along. You know, we go to weddings. Like, I try to include the family as much as possible. Why wouldn't I? That's the history of AA. And then when Al-Anon was formed and then Alateen in 1957. So why wouldn't I try to do that? Again, my family was riddled with alcoholism. You look at a blue car outside, everybody would tell you it's a red car. You'd want to talk about your feelings. People would tell you to shut up. You know, there was just no opportunity for truth. And it's amazing because all I ever wanted was to sit across the kitchen table from somebody and have an honest conversation. And I had no idea that I'd be doing that every day in Alcoholics Anonymous. So what a gift. I mean, you can't rob me of anything. You can't take anything from me. And the only thing I can give you is my peace of mind and serenity, which I'm unwilling to do today. But that's a really good place because I grew up in such turmoil. You know, it's a threefold illness. You got the spiritual, you know, the hole in the soul and the never being satisfied and always feeling alone and this kind of stuff. But then you also got the physical allergy and the mental obsession. And none of those allowed me to be useful or be connected. But now that I'm free from those and I'm exploring the spiritual aspect, I can do that. There's a story of my alcoholism when my grandmother was in the hospital dying, and my mother called me up and said, you know, turn your hazards on and hurry up and get to the hospital. And, you know, I said, yeah, no problem, Ma. You know, of course, who doesn't want to see their grandmother? And what do you think I needed to do? I needed to drink. I used to think I was such a bad person, but I realized I was just so self-centered. I was sick. I needed to drink. I needed to drink. I needed to drink. And I was a great pretender. You know, when I was young, I was in a gang. And where I'm from, when you're in a gang, you wear beads. And you don't ever take your beads off unless somebody tries to rip them off or you fight or whatever. And I was so proud, and I thought I was hot stuff and such a tough guy. But I would easily take those beads off and hide them and go across town the other side of Newark and hang out with a guy I knew in a rival gang so I can drink. Because you know what trumped family every time, and you know what trumped colors every time, and you know what trumped beads every time? It was alcohol. I wanted to know where the alcohol was. I wanted alcohol over relationships, women, God, whatever. The funny thing is, like most relationships in my life, I hated alcohol, but I still drank it every day, all day. Not only did I hate the taste of alcohol, but I hated what it did to my family. And I swore up and down that I'd never drink, and I drank so much I couldn't stop, you know? Obviously, I drank for the effect. Obviously, I liked what the effect was, but I had a very hateful relationship with alcohol. Very young, I thought two things all the time. We'd move around a lot, my mother and I, Jersey City, Staten Island, back and forth, New York, New Jersey, this, that, and often felt alone. You know, I wasn't bullied. It wasn't like hard for me to talk to women. I was pretty good in sports. Like all that was good, but it didn't matter. I always felt like something was missing. I never felt right. I'd be driving over to Brooklyn Bridge and I'd look up at the sun, and I later on realized, you know, it's amazing in AA, especially if you tell your story a lot, you're sober a while, and there's people in this room that could tell you this better than me. They've been around longer than me. But it's not so much you lie when you change your story. It's like you're always learning more of the truth. So if I told my story at 1 year sober and then at 5 years sober and then 10 and 15 and 20 and even last week, if you heard me, it's not that I'm lying. It's just I realize things different. For years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would share that I didn't take my first drink until I was 12 or 13. Now, that one was an outright lie because I started drinking at 5. I was stealing shots. I was stealing what was left over in the beer bottles and stuff like that. But, like, I didn't count that, even in AA, because that's normal. You don't count that. That's, you know, alcohol didn't do anything yet. You don't count that. You know what I mean? So, like, it's amazing. The world of ignorance is not just outside of AA. Sometimes it's even right here in this room. And I'm talking about me. I'm not accusing any of you. I'm saying me. The ignorance is with me. You know, 164, we talk all the time, what can I do for the man who is still sick? I'm still sick. I work this program. I'm free from the obsession. I give any waking free time I can to Alcoholics Anonymous. My family understands the importance of this program, but I'm still sick. I'm only well a day at a time through this maintenance. So anyways, I looked up at the sun, and I said to this sun, I said, you know, we're on the Brooklyn Bridge. I said, you know, let this car go off the bridge and kill my mother. My father wasn't around. I didn't really know him. I told you about all the turmoil in my family. My uncle kidnapped me when I was 3 after he drank. Like, it was just violence after violence after violence. And I just wanted my mom to die, and I wanted everybody to feel bad for me. But think of how self-centered that was. Not to mention, my mother did everything for me. I mean, she would have hole in her clothes so I could have the Reebok pumps. I don't know if you guys remember the Reebok pumps, but, you know, I definitely wanted the Reebok pumps. They didn't work. They didn't help me play basketball any better, but they were just cool. You know, that whole status symbol. Alcohol did something to me about 12 or 13, like I said. I lived most of my life thinking homicidal and suicidal thoughts. I wanted to kill myself and get off this planet. I wanted to kill you and get you out of my face. And this is how I thought. This was my thinking. It's amazing when I look back at my history, just how dark it is. It's just so dark. Alcoholism is so dark. With or without a drink, alcoholism is dark. You know, it's amazing. How can I ever say no to Alcoholics Anonymous? How can I ever not be the first one to line, what do you need, AA? What does the home group need? How can I not be the first one with my hand up when the district needs help, when somebody needs a sponsor? How can I not stay up to 2 a.m. when somebody has an issue? So many people did it for me. Without Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd be up till 5 a.m. throwing my guts up. waking up every day with the spinnies, with my face frozen to the floor again because I passed out. In some city or town, I have no idea. And by the way, I was only 19 when I came here, and I already had delirium tremens. Another reason I love service is I went to the Crisis Intervention Center at 17. I went to 17 institutions. This was one of them. I don't know exactly what time, but I remember I had DTs. I had panic attacks. I had anxiety. I had hallucinations. Nobody talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous or alcoholism. Just wanted to talk about how my dad was such a bad dad, or I was the poorest kid on the block, or somebody looked a little different than me, so I was mad. We didn't talk about alcoholism. And that was back in, you know, whatever, the early 90s. It's not like nobody knew of AA. This is why it's so important for the group to be involved in the community, for the individuals to take responsibility and do service and carry the message. So I had a hole in the soul from an early age. I was on a lot of sports teams. I was very good at soccer. I was pretty good at basketball and baseball and all this stuff. I traveled all over for soccer. Threw it all away once it came down to booze. And you know, it's amazing for how long I actually played sports, even while I was drinking. But obviously, I couldn't function. I'm sure I thought I was in my head. I'm one of those kids that got kicked out of a whole bunch of schools. And again, it doesn't make you an alcoholic because you're in trouble all the time. It really doesn't. It's the hole in the soul. It's the mental obsession. It's the physical craving. But I was one of those kids that was in trouble all the time. I went to a school. After you get kicked out of the school, you get kicked out of another one, and then you go here. You know, they serve meals on roach coaches. This is my school, outside, outdoors, no matter what the weather, roach coaches. And we played basketball inside a cage, you know, because there'd always be fights. So that's the kind of high school I went to. And when you left class, they would call your name until you get back to class, and you would just ignore it. And they would ignore it, too, because they didn't want to chase you. You know, and I wasn't a stupid kid. Again, I was just so self-absorbed, so sick, and so stuck in alcohol. I mean, I still can't even, we like the big book in this meeting. I already know we do, but we like the big book, and we like the line that says indescribably wonderful. And we understand what that means because AA is so indescribably wonderful. Like sometimes I feel like I can't describe it. Well, I also feel like alcoholism is indescribably awful. And even as I sit here, I don't feel like I can justify. I feel like I have to keep telling you over and over again how painful, how tormenting, and how dark it was. It was just unbelievable how many times I wanted to stop. I had no intention to drink again. I swore up and down I was done. I didn't want to get in trouble. I didn't want to hurt my mom anymore. And immediately following that thought, I was off to the races again. Or in some cases, it wasn't even a thought and I just started drinking. It's just unbelievable. My mother came to pick me up in jail. She stayed in some hotel where some guy was murdered. Poor woman. She's coming to pick up her son. She's in a hotel. There's all this stuff. She comes to jail. I didn't have my clothes. I had my browns on because the correctional officer stole my clothes. I walked right past my mother. I didn't even say hi. I didn't even say I love you. I didn't hug her. I didn't say thank you. I went right to the payphone. You guys remember payphones. And I called somebody up, and I had to go drink. That's what I did. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I hugged my mother from like 13 to 19. In other words, I didn't hug her a lot that I lost count. I meant I don't even know if I did once. Like, that's just how, like, separated and isolated and divided we get. And I told you, I was a great pretender. Depending on what time of day and how much alcohol I had in me, you could think I'm one of a million things, but the night always ended up the same. There was some sort of intervention. I passed out, blacked out, got pulled over, got arrested, something of that sort, every time. And I don't have a choice, even today, at almost 22 years sober. My sponsor offered me permanent recovery. I needed to do strenuous work, but he offered me permanent recovery, which was a very hopeful statement for an individual like me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Very, very hopeful statement. But in order to have that permanent recovery, I need to do strenuous work, which I'm going to get into here. But the mental obsession in this choice, sometimes we talk about in AA, I chose not to drink today. Obviously, you can have your own experience, but for me, I can't choose not to drink. I lose every time. I lose every time. And the minute I start thinking I have a choice, then what am I doing at this meeting tonight? Why am I working a 10-step? Who wants to admit defeat? Who wants to tell someone you're wrong again? I don't have a choice even today, and I'm not ashamed to say that. I'm not ashamed to say I understand my illness. I understand to say I'm mentally sick. I'm deranged. My thinking is not well. But I also know there's a lot of hope. I have a network. I have a home group. I have a program. And all is good. So treatment centers, I mean, they were a joke. I'm not going to get into the specifics, but I would literally get into these treatment centers and either get in relationships, steal a car from the counselor and drive off, or one of a number of enormously either dark or funny things, depending what mood you're in, but none of that's really necessary. But that's what my alcoholism was, you know, pre-AA. I'll never forget being on the third story of a building in New Jersey. You know, today, like, it'd be such a great meeting. I remember everybody was happy. There was coffee. There was tall people, fat people, black, white, Hispanic. It was such a beautiful, eclectic room. I almost think sometimes I'm making it up. That's how bright the room was. And I really wanted to get sober that day. I mean, think about it. I showed up at an AA meeting and went up three flights of stairs. I wanted to get well. But the minute I walked through the threshold, I turned right back around. And what do you think I did? I drank again. You know? That's what I mean about a choice. No matter what, my head always convinces me. It talks to me in my own voice. Right when I'm about to get well, you don't know these people. Why don't you go somewhere where you know somebody? Why don't you call your friend up? You know, whatever, my head will always separate me. You know, I use this magnifying glass, metaphoric magnifying glass every day to look at every thought and action I have. I'm either going towards God or a drink. Everything I do is under that microscope. So what is this action? What is this thought? What are these words? Is this taking me towards God or is it taking me towards a drink? Came to AA to stay. Like I said, in November 28th of 1998, I had just gotten jumped by about five or six guys with guns and beer bottles. And I went to the door of my mother, who enabled me all her life with swollen mastoids. I didn't even know what that was until I looked it up, but I had swollen mastoids and I was bleeding and I was not in good shape. And my mother said, nope, not this time. And good for her. And that should tell you something, because a woman taught me a long time ago in AA, you could love somebody to the grave. And she taught me the difference between brutal and honesty. Like, there's no such thing as being compassionate, being brutal. And just because you're honest don't mean you need to be brutal. But you need to be firm with an alcoholic. And when the alcoholic hears the truth, it has a certain ring to it and they respond. At least I did, and at least the people I work with do. So I was so grateful that my mother closed that door. And I think about that when I work with sponsees. It's okay to say no. It's okay to talk about the truth. But, you know, you come from an alcoholic home like I did, like, the truth was not normal. So it wasn't okay to talk about the truth. You'd lie about anything for any reason. You say you watched a movie when you couldn't even mention one person that was in it. You know, you say you just hit a home run in your baseball game and you didn't even have a game. It's the fall. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just, that's the kind of things we do. Anyway, I came to AA to stay, and I had some problems at Newark Airport, but I eventually made it down to South Florida to stay in a treatment center. My probation officer was a very nice man. He bought me a suit so I could see my mother for Christmas before I left. I was about 2 weeks sober. But in order to follow through on this thing when I got locked up, and so I wouldn't stay away for a while, I had to go down. And I wanted to stop. And I had this urge or this idea that I was never going to drink again, but I had no idea what that meant or how to do that. And one of my first meetings was we read, you know, A Vision for You. And we read that couldn't live with alcohol and couldn't live without alcohol. And I knew loneliness as we know it, because I realized I can't drink anymore. But at the same time, what am I going to do without a drink? And I was terrified, just like it describes in the chapter. And that's when I knew I was going to love that book, because it spoke my language. And thank God for the AA literature, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous at some of the clubhouses I was going to, even inside these treatment centers, everybody was talking about heroin and overdosing on heroin. And I never did heroin, so I thought maybe I shouldn't be in AA. What am I doing here? Maybe I'm in the wrong place. But thank God for those other shades that were on the wall, the 12 traditions. And I've come to sense know that it's not that drugs are a disqualifier. You can certainly have done drugs and been in AA, but alcohol is the qualifier. That's what gets us here. That's what we communicate about. That's what keeps us here. That's what binds us. It says in my big book, in the chapter, there is a solution: common peril plus common solution. So alcoholism plus 12 steps equals the cement which binds us. And I have relationships today that you couldn't break up if you tried. I have people that you could spread gossip about me and they'd say, no, that's not correct. and vice versa, which feels really good because usually everybody was trying to avoid me or arrest me or violate me. It's a very different story. Anyways, went to this treatment center, got kicked out like I do everything else. Probation officer was nice enough to say, listen, as long as you don't drink, man, and you get through this, I got your back. You'll be fine. And thank God for that, man, because I was homeless for the first year and a half in sobriety. I didn't know how to live. Because of the fact I grew up in alcoholism and we didn't have honest discussions and I didn't really, you know, I'm not putting this on any of my family members, but we didn't really learn how to live. And then my self-inflicted illness, drinking at a young age and doing nothing but running on the streets, I didn't know what to do when I came to AA. I didn't know what to do on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, because all I knew how to do was drink, you know? And I knew I had an abnormal reaction to a perfectly normal liquid. When I ingested alcohol, I was already thinking about the seventh or eighth drink. And I needed more. And as soon as I had some, I felt a little better, but then I was already afraid of when am I going to get the rest? And I had to have a stash. And I had friends that I got some from, but I also kept some on the side that I wouldn't share. And mind you, I was 19 when I came in. And although there was a couple of different bars that I was allowed in, for the most part, it wasn't as easy to get alcohol as someone who was of age. Here we are. Physical craving, mental obsession, hole in the soul. I kicked out of this treatment center, homeless for the first year and a half, and I went to a men's meeting. It's called Five Time Losers. And the big book says we are people who would normally not mix. And that's what my first sponsor and grand sponsor were. Tommy was a 6'5" black guy, an ex-gangster from Dallas. And his sponsor was Jimmy, a white racist from Pittsburgh. And these guys were sitting next to each other at the meeting with their legs crossed, loving each other. Loving each other. Reminiscing on how stupid and ignorant they were back in the day because of alcoholism. The funny thing about AA, and I am not going to use this platform to get political or say anything stupid, but I will tell you the funny thing about AA, it gives me so much more than I ever realized. Because when I walk outside my door, even today in 2020, some things seem really dark to me and I get really concerned. But I feel very safe inside Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel very safe when I'm working with a sponsee. I feel very safe when I'm working with my sponsor, when I'm involved in service, when I get to go to the prison on Christmas Eve and sit in a room with 24 inmates who by their own self-imposed crisis will never see the light of day again. Homicide, other things, home invasions, armed robbery. But some of those people are more spiritual than the people at my group. I'm sitting there with grown men crying, talking about carrying the message. So anyways, met Tommy, we went through the book. My first step prayer was, God, I'm an alcoholic and I need your help today. And he explained to me that I needed to talk to God all through the day. I couldn't just say good morning and good night. That's not much of a relationship. I needed to build a relationship. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't know what that meant. He said, you want to make God a friend. I didn't know what friends were. I just knew people that had alcohol and people who didn't. I was the kind of guy who would sell a stolen phone card, if you remember phone card, a stolen phone card on Ferry Street, Newark, New Jersey. That's what I was doing. I didn't know what friends were. But I understood what he meant, kind of, sort of. Because I did grow up wishing I had a friend, a true friend. I did grow up wishing that I had someone to talk to and be honest with and I could be myself with. So I understood that. And that's what AA gave me. The greatest thing Alcoholics Anonymous gave me was the ability to choose my own conception of a higher power. And at that same men's meeting, Raheem's father, Raheem was a kid I ran with when I was out there. His father, Derek Kane, was from the same neighborhood as me in Newark. And he shared his experience, strength, and hope with 8 years sober. And he was crying. And this is a guy who didn't cry. And this is a guy who was, I guess, kind of what I wanted to be, tough, or whatever you would say. But he was talking about love and hope and respect and amends and follow through and integrity. And I was like, wow, wow. And AA's cool, man, AA's big. One of the first meetings I went to was a Nubian meeting. And I was welcome. Big hugs and big arms, welcome. And that's the cool thing about AA. You know, I like to mix things in through the experience. I mean, in service, you get to learn a lot and hear a lot. And Alcoholics Anonymous, if you know what the Gaza Strip is, there's Jews and Muslims arguing in the name of God for 2,000 years, killing each other in the name of God. But also, there's an AA meeting where Jews and Muslims are holding hands. and carrying a message of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how powerful AA is. Drinking was a big phenomenon for me, a big phenomenon. So in order to get well, I needed an even bigger phenomenon. And that's what I came to believe was God. And thank God for God. I'll tell you this much. I don't pray much these days. I'm going to say I pray when I talk about the 10th or 11th step, but what I really do is I communicate with my higher power. When I was brand new, I got on my knees and I prayed a lot, but today God is my friend. I communicate with my higher power all day, and it's a constant conversation. I don't know anything else to do. I don't know any other way to feel well. And I'll tell you, one of the greatest gifts that I had was having an alcoholic house, an alcoholic family, and being hopeless from alcohol, because without any of that, I wouldn't be interested in any of these things you guys are suggesting. Wouldn't be interested. Remember when I was locked up, I thought I was just suicidal and something was wrong with me. But I realized later on in my fourth step that I needed to drink. I wanted to drink. My whole life revolved around drinking. So that first step was important. We went through those first 44 pages and I understood why I didn't show up for my grandmother. I understood why I kept drinking even though I didn't want to. I understood why I ended up in treatment after treatment and yada, yada, yada. Hole in the soul, mental obsession, spiritual malady. Choose my own conception of higher power. As soon as I got to the chapter, we agnostics, I became willing to believe. And I paid attention to words in that chapter like seeds. Because the way it works for me in my life is I'll think everything's going really well, but it's not. And I'll also think everything's really bad, but it's actually pretty good. Not being able to differentiate the truth from the false is not just when I'm drinking. It's part of the illness I have in my mind, which is why I need steps 10 and 11, which is why I need a sponsor. I need to show up here in Virginia tonight, and I need to listen to what you guys have to offer when it's your turn to share. I need to stay humble. An alcoholic of my type cannot be famous for getting sober. They will drink again. They have to be a worker among workers. They have to be just a member. They have to be. And I try to give that to my sponsees the most I can. And, you know, I do a lot of workshops and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, when I'm doing traditions or a service workshop or something, and somebody says, hey, Craig, you're going to come back again and do it again? Well, if you need some help, but how about when you guys do it? That's the whole point. I did all this so that you could go do it. You know, same thing with the sponsee when they get to the 12 step. Oh, why don't you take him? I'm not ready for him. Well, I thought that too. I'm here for you, brother, but it's your turn. Because it's not Craig AA, it's AA. You know, it's the organization, it's the entity. Anyways, second step. I asked God for his protection and care. My sponsor said I didn't have to white knuckle anymore. I didn't have to hold on to the chair. I asked him for protection and care as I abandoned myself to him. I asked God to help me let go of old ideas and old ways just for today. That's what one day at a time means to me. I don't battle alcohol one day at a time. I grow spiritually one day at a time. I will lose the battle to alcohol every day, all day. But I can grow spiritually one day at a time. I don't choose not to drink. I choose to pick up the spiritual gift of tools. Took a third step, got on my hands and knees with this man, said the third step prayer. And those words are still powerful to this day. I understand what it means to ask to be relieved from the bondage itself. There is no, listen, I didn't do hard time, but still there is no jail like the alcoholic mind. It's unbelievable. You know, I learned in my fourth step, the pain I carried with me for so long, some of it wasn't even real. Some of it wasn't even real. All I have to be is in a bad mood, and I make dialogues about my neighbors. I make dialogues about funny ways people look at me. It's what I do. My alcoholism is working 24 hours a day to find a way to divide me from you and bring me back to the drink. At 22 years sober, my alcoholism is more vicious than it was when I got here. But I'm also more desperate than I was when I got here. Thank God. Took that third step, started writing my fourth step. I was angry at everybody and everything. I was mad at bottled water. I didn't want to pay for it. I was mad at my father for not being there. I love dogs, and I was mad at my dog because it got to sleep all day and somebody fed it. I wanted to sleep all day and have somebody feed me. managed the New York City school system. I mean, you name it. Basically, I had four legal pads of resentment. I was angry at everybody. And I said the prayer in my third column of my fourth step, and I asked God to soften my heart and show me how I could behave like these people. And I looked at my side of the street on every anger and resentment I had, and it was just a constant pattern of selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, frightened, selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, frightened, controlling, manipulative, vindictive, mean-spirited, controlling, controlling, controlling. And it's funny because the guy who I really respect taught me a long time ago, it's interesting when we hear the alcoholic even talk about control, because the delusion is that we even have control. We don't have control over anything. And that's even beyond alcohol. It says in our big book that resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. The way I read that is resentment kills you even more than alcohol does. I've known people in AA blow their brains out because they didn't have a message. I've been there. I've thought about wanting to do stuff that I'm not proud of in sobriety. There's nothing like coming home from a meeting and looking in that rearview mirror and just that hole in the soul you get 3-4 years sober. Nothing like it. Kept doing my four step, went through my fears. I'll keep it simple. I was afraid of everything. But the fear prayer I love is, God, please remove my fear. For example, before I speak, I always say the same prayer. God, please remove my fear of sounding good and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And I don't ask God what he'd have me do. That's kind of a silly question, but I asked, what would he have me be? And he would have me be open and honest, because I have a lot to offer, and that's not cocky. I've been here a while. I've seen a few things. I've worked hard. But because I say I have a lot to offer doesn't mean that I think you don't, or doesn't mean that I think I have more than you. I just have confidence today where it used to be cocky. And it's because of that fear prayer. I'm going for a new job. God, please remove my fear of this job and direct my attention where you'd have me be. God would have me be of service, open and honest. I mean, simple, simple tools that I had no idea. I didn't know how to live. Sex conduct, I used people. That's it. It's that simple. The way I describe a four step is I was angry at everything. I was afraid of everything. I wanted to have sex with everything, and I hurt everything. That's my four step. And I was able to share that with a sponsor and create some ideals of how to have platonic relationships and sexual relationships and think outside of myself. And what can I give and what can I bring? Alcoholics Anonymous has opened my eyes to this idea of something outside of myself. I was so full of myself before AA, and I thought it was what I wanted, but man, it wasn't. And there's nothing better today than to know what you're doing and how you're doing and what I can do for you, for two reasons, because I'm actually sincerely, genuinely interested today, but also it keeps me out of my head. It gives me relief. My sponsor spent 48 hours with me on my fifth step, broken up. And I'll never forget when I moved to Connecticut the first time from Jersey. I was at a young person's meeting and a kid came up to me. We were at the 24-hour Starbucks, came up to me at 1 a.m. and he said, Craig, my sponsor hasn't been returning my calls. I don't trust him. I've watched you for a while. I trust you. I want you to hear my fifth step. And we went over to the commuter lot, and I had to be at work at 6:30 a.m. And we went over and we listened to his fifth step. And I didn't get a wink of sleep that day, but I felt so energized by the time I went to work because I helped this kid look at his patterns like my sponsor did with me. Listen, I'm not just talking it. If there's anybody in this room, and I'm sure there's plenty of folks in here that are happy to help you, but if there's anyone in this room that feels like they're not getting or they want something different, happy to give you my number, happy to be of service. And that's real. I'm not just saying it. Take my number. Let's talk. And I don't need to be your sponsor. We could just talk. You can let me know what you're doing in Virginia. I'll let you know what I'm doing over here. That's what AA is, man. We save lives in AA every day, every single day. And it's just regular. We save lives so often, we forget we save lives. But there's also a lot that leave. The thing about AA is nobody's going to come up to the chairperson at the group and tell you that they didn't like this comment against a transgender or this racial comment or this implication that you're not important. They're not going to come up and tell you that. You're just going to walk out the door and you're never going to see them again. So it's very important that we understand what we're doing here. and why we're here and what our primary purpose is. I don't know about you, but without AA, I am nothing. So I don't really want to go to the group to talk about the Yankees. I don't. I love the Yankees, the best baseball team, but I don't want to go there and I don't want to talk about it. It's not what we're there for. I want to carry the message. You know, I'm still sick. So anyways, ask God to make sure I didn't leave anything out. Did a six step. I love the six step prayer. God, please help me let go of the things to which I still cling so that I could walk your will and your purpose. And I was a good talker, but now I had to actually walk it, you know, and that's what separates the men from the boys. As we read in 12 and 12, the six step is such a small paragraph in a big book, but it's so powerful. Because if I really work these first five as hard as I need to, the sixth step is really very simple. There's nothing to talk about. I need to move on. So I take a seventh step and I prepare for amends and I write an eighth step list and I ask for forgiveness for every single person on my eighth step list. And I ask God to help me clear away the debris of self-will and self-reliant living. And I say, thy will be done for them as well as for me. And then I ask God to help me do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences might be. And I go out and make amends. And I made amends to my father. My father, I only saw him a couple times in my life. I waited on the stoop so many times for that man, and he never showed up. I had so many phone calls with that man telling me how it was my mother's fault, not mine. Never did we talk about his drinking. I don't really have any fond memories. The one cool thing that happened when I was in PS 36, he stopped somebody from, he was a New York City fireman, he stopped somebody from killing themselves, and the Staten Island Advance wanted to take a photograph with, you know, him and his child, so he came to my school. And I was kind of famous in the school because they put me over the loudspeaker and I went outside and I took a picture with these New York City cops, New York City firemen, the chief and all that. And it's amazing how distorted alcoholism is, because everybody in the school is like, wow, man, you got a cool dad. And wow, that's awesome. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, I don't even know this guy. I don't even know him. It's amazing. But anyway, so I was so mad at this man. When I was homeless in sobriety, I found him and I took money from him because I was hungry. And I didn't care. I told my sponsor, I'll rob him all day long. I'll carry the message in prison. I don't care. He's a man. If he wanted to have me, he should have been there. Very resentful. I also robbed a safe. And I swore up and down to my sponsor I didn't have to make amends for that, because the safe I robbed was from a company that enslaved people in South America. So I was entitled to steal money. So I had a lot to do, even in sobriety. Even in sobriety, I had a lot to do. Just being honest with you. Anyways, I made amends to my father for the money I took. I wrote him a check plus interest. He asked if I wanted a relationship with him. I said no. I just wanted to make wrong my right. A good friend of mine, Billy, later on said, why don't you go visit him? So I saw him at 15 years sober. I was 15 years sober. And he was supposed to take me out to eat. The check came and he slid the check right over to me. Had no interest in paying for the check. And then I tried to open up to him to be vulnerable. And I told him how I lost a child. And he said, that's all right. They're expensive anyway. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, you didn't even pay for me. And now how are you going to tell me they're expensive? So I was very sad. But I cried for the next 3 months in AA every time I shared this story, because I forgave my dad. And I was willing to carry the message to him if he wanted it. And the minute I knew that and accepted that, he said, hey, Craig, let's go down to the go-karts. I'll take you for a ride on the go-karts. Now, granted, I'm like 30 years old at this time. And he's a retired fat New York City fireman. But all my life, I wondered, what's it like to have a dad? What's it like to hold a man's hand that's your father? What's it like to have a man tell you how to cook or how to shave or that he loves you or whatever? But I got an answer. I knew for a couple minutes what it was like to have a dad. He bought me a go-kart race and we hung out and we had some fun. So AA gave me that. And to some people that might seem small, but to me that was huge, because I was dominated by my father. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and the mental obsession left me, I obsessed about where my father was, and I was entitled. I was so entitled to behave however I wanted to because I didn't have a father. So that was good. I'm going to move forward. I have a lot of immense stories, but I'm going to move forward here to my 10th step. I'll tell you something I always tell about the 10th step. Again, to give you an illustration of where I was. I was homeless. A guy from California, Ben, got me a job, started selling cars. I didn't like the way the sales manager talked to me. If you've ever bought a car, you know the people in the showroom, they just don't know how to talk to people. So I took a book and I slapped my manager in the face with it. And they were kind enough to send me home for 3 days. And thank God I still kept my job. I came back and I said, you know, Chris, if you weren't such an a-hole, I wouldn't have smacked you. And I didn't even wait for his response. I ran outside. I got on the phone. I called Tommy. And I was like, Tommy, I just made an amends. And he said, that is not an amends, Craig. But that's where I came from. I really thought, I mean, for me, that was growth. And in a way, not that I'm suggesting you do any of this, but in a way, I got to spend time with God because my mother, my home group, my sponsor, my friends, I'm never going to live up to their expectations. But when I can talk with my higher power and know where I used to be and where I am today, it's a very good feeling. And that was growth for me that day. Nowhere near an ideal, but it was growth. Today, I'd rather be a preventer than a fixer. I'd rather not have to say sorry. I'd rather ask you how you're doing instead of waiting for you to tell me you're suffering. I'd rather offer to help you move rather than be the last guy on the list when everybody's going around asking and I'm like, I don't know, call me later. You know? I learned something a long time ago. My mother, I would tell my mother I'll be back in a couple of minutes. And she would hate to get the phone call wondering if I was locked up again or dead or in jail. And this is what I experienced in early sobriety. I played sober softball. And I'll never forget, I was mad. I was mad when someone was 2 minutes late. I was so angry. 2 minutes late and I was angry. My mother spent a large portion of her life not knowing where I was. Or was I going to come back in an envelope, a canister, or was she going to hear about me on the news? Devastating. So I'm not going to get into the story, but I made amends to my mom and that's become powerful. And we have a good relationship today. And I shared with you, you know, we spoke. And the first time when I got back from the General Service Conference as a delegate, Panel 65 delegate, I felt wonderful because I did interactions with the delegate from Ukraine. I dealt with all these people around the U.S. and Canada. We made major decisions for Alcoholics Anonymous, and we changed some of the things we were going to do with literature and this and that. And all that stuff was wonderful and great. But I got to speak on the panel with my mother, and there was nothing better than that. That was the first time I spoke with my mother. And in case you can't tell, I'm a very fluid person. It's very easy for me to talk. But that day at that convention, I spent most of the time crying. Because I watched my mother talk about the truth. For years, I wondered when she was going to see the same thing I saw. Didn't you see what I saw? And there it was. Another thing Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. It's a family illness. It absolutely is. And I had sponsees all the time that tell me, yeah, but Craig, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. My parents didn't drink. I said, yeah, but you did. That's an alcoholic home. You were alcoholic and it was the home. That's an alcoholic home. Like, it's a family illness. We affect people, you know? Anyways, I love the 11th step. I'm going to try to illustrate my idea of the 11th step in case you've never heard this before. If you have heard it, then I'm very happy. But, you know, so here I am. I share with you. I do these first 10 steps. Hopefully, I'm trying to correct my mistakes and trying to make amends for the things I've done wrong. And I'm trying to keep my side of the street clean with the 10th step. And I spend time with my eyes closed and quiet. I've done a lot of things in my life, drum circles, Buddhist temples, slam poetry, travel, this, that. I did everything I could to try to improve my spirituality. But the best thing for me is page 86 in the big book. It tells me my problem, my solution. It keeps it simple. I close my eyes at night. I look at where I was through the day, resentful, dishonest, afraid. I look at where I was kind and loving, where I wasn't. I ask my higher power, you know, what I could do better. Most important question on there is, what am I keeping to myself, which I should discuss with another person at once? Because that's what's going to kill me. And I had so many reservations when I was brand new in AA. And I love the beginning chapters where we talk about lurking notions and reservations. And I love when we talk about the bedevilments in We Agnostics, page 52, and how back in early AA days during Lunar Flight, which was a big event, they cared more about solving their alcoholic dilemma than Lunar Flight. And I understand today, me doing spiritual work is more important than the Super Bowl or the World Series or any of these things. I've learned today how to have my cake and eat it, but early on, I needed to make that the most important thing. But the reservations I have today, because alcoholism is interesting. So if you were to ask me, and I don't want to spoil any question, but if somebody was to ask me, well, Craig, do you think you have reservations today? And I would say, well, let me open up my 8-step list. And if I have anybody on my 8-step list I haven't made amends to, that's my reservation to drink right there. That's my reservation to drink right there. I need to be willing to make amends. I need to be willing to correct my wrongs I need to be willing to continually to grow spiritually. And I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're not talking about that. I'd like to hear more about that. I'd like to talk about that. I do talk about it. Anyways, I do all this. I ask God to show me my mistakes throughout the day. I ask God to show me what corrective measures I need to take. And then I write it down on a note card or a pad. And, you know, I go to sleep and then I wake up in the morning and I ask God to divorce my thinking from dishonest and self-seeking motives. And I immediately ask him for the power to make those corrections. Now, if you came to my house today, it's a brand new house. It was built 9 months ago. My wife's a beautiful woman. My son's very intelligent. My mom, we built their apartment downstairs. Things are good. We got 3 dogs, just had a pool built, got some landscaping, a guy who came from nothing. He's got all this. That's cool. I got a nice car. I got a lot of friends. The only reason I'm telling you this is I didn't get any of that by chasing anything. God gave it to me. All I did since my first sponsor was clean up my past, continue to make my wrongs right, and continue to share my secrets. Because the old timers, we make fun of them all the time for their one-liners, but we're as sick as their secrets is so true. Anything I'm holding on to is going to keep me sick and potentially could bring me back to a drink. I talk to God all through the day, man, four or 500 times a day. And I know when I say that, some people look at me like, come on, dude, you're out of your mind. Well, if you think of yourself a million times a day like me, 400 or 500 times a day ain't much. And I'm always asking him, please help me to be present. Please help me to be useful. How can I help my son? What can I do for my wife? When I'm in a car, please help me stop at the stop sign. Please help me not. I'll never forget the time I was supposed to be a spiritual speaker at a convention. I was talking to my former sponsor, Jimmy, and I was literally on the way, but I had to stop at the bank, and this guy cut me off, and I'm on the phone with my sponsor, and I'm getting out of the car, and I'm like, we could do this right now. Like, I will F you up. Like, I'm sorry if I'm embarrassing myself, but that's what I was doing, and I'm about to go be the spiritual speaker. I mean, come on. It's just like, you know, what is it? We have to work this thing every day, all day. All the work I do in AA, I do today, every day. 12 step, looks like about 5 to 7 minutes. Is that about right, David? Okay, thank you. So Dr. Bob said it. Another guy told me it. But, you know, we carry the message and sometimes use words. Point of that is, what are our actions? And that's what I try to be. And as flawed as I am, I know if you ask my wife, my stepson, my mother, my sponsees, my sponsor, they will tell you Craig shows up, Craig does the work. That's what I want to be known as today. That's the ideals. I do show up. I do put the work in. As far as something specific with sponsorship, I kind of already told you how someone sponsored me because I went through all those steps. But, you know, I'm a pretty hardline sponsor. I'm looking for a long-term relationship. So if you're coming to me for help, I'm not automatically saying yes. I'm making an appointment to talk. I'm trying to see what your expectations are. I'm telling you what mine are, making sure we're on the same page. If you say you're interested in what I have, I start with the preface and the forewords in the big book. I don't immediately qualify them, whether or not they're alcoholic. I tell them what the organization is, what the history is, how many different big books we have, how many countries we're in, how to get a hold of us, what the opportunities are, what you could do at your membership. Because why be a part of an organization you're not interested in being a part of? So I let them know who we are and who we're not, so they can decide if they want to be a member or not. And then we get into those pages to qualify them whether or not they're alcoholic. And then we get into the steps the same way my sponsor got into it with me. And then I told you, I'm looking for long-term relationships with my sponsees. So we're going through the 12 steps in the book. We're going through the 12 traditions in A Comes of Age and Language of the Heart. We're going through the 12 concepts in the service manual. And if you look inside the big book, in the front of the big book, it tells you all the conference-approved literature that's available, not even including Grapevine. We go through all that literature, not in 2 weeks, not in a month, but long-term relationship. And then in the back of the book, it has all different pamphlets that are available. We're going through those pamphlets because if I'm sponsoring you, you get involved in the home group. You're going to get involved in service. Listen, I have one less sponsee than I need. And I'll tell you this, and I don't even want to say it because it's recording, but I'll tell you this. I sponsor a lot of guys. And I only say that for two reasons. One, it's possible. And everyone I sponsor is involved in general service, in the home group, in the steps, traditions, and concepts. I think that should be a standard. Imagine to go to the car dealership to buy a car and there's no steering wheel or there's no door handle. If you read the history of AA, Bill and Bob gave this over to us in the 50s. It's our responsibility. It's our job to pay the money to keep it going. It's our job to put the service work and the effort in to carry the message. We got to get into the prisons, the treatment centers, the nursing homes. I was so proud of the Public Information Committee out here when COVID first hit. And out here, you couldn't go anywhere. But they still went and they put flyers at the pharmacy. So when people went to get their medicine, they would see that A was on Zoom. And we were continuing to carry the message. And we were calling the older members to see if they know how to do Zoom and how to get on. Are they afraid to get on? How can we help you log on? And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember when I was homeless in that first year and a half, the young persons group gave me a coffee commitment. Now, they were smart. They gave me the coffee commitment, but they made me feel like I was of service, but Mike held the keys. They didn't give me the keys, so they were smart, but they let me be involved. And then I was the intergroup rep, and then literature and treasurer, then I was a GSR, then I was a DCM, then I was remote communities committee. I remember hearing about in Canada how people were driving on dog sleds in life-threatening conditions to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bring a Bigfoot to somebody in 8 hours of freezing tundra where they can die. And here I was complaining because I didn't like what meeting was available on Tuesday night. It's amazing what service does. It just opens your eyes to how big Alcoholics Anonymous is and how much you can do. And I served as an area treasurer, and I'll never forget getting a check from a local group for 25 cents. And what they did was they paid their rent and they did the spiritual side of the seven tradition. Even though there was no more money left except that 25 cents, they still sent it to be part of the service structure. I remember hearing in Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina, when it wiped out people's homes, never mind meeting spaces, people had nowhere to live and people were giving money all around the country. And the Louisiana Assembly got together and said, we can't accept that money. We have our own higher power, and in accordance with the seven tradition, we need to pay our own way. What a powerful example. The right thing is never easy. So these are the things I saw. And I also, I'll share two more stories with you and then I'll end it. When I served as delegate general service conference, one of the coolest experiences I had many, wish I had time to tell you them all, but I had many. I was speaking at the New York City, Southeast New York convention, and I met Jennifer. And Jennifer was a transgender who had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for years. And she had transitioned while she was in AA. And she used to be a male and now she's a female. And we were updating the LGBTQ pamphlet at the time. And we were taking in stories and it was amazing to hear. I came to AA, and now granted, I grew up in an urban setting and my family's very eclectic, but you know, I'm a white male and nobody was really trying to kick me out. But we have actual members telling people they can't come here because what kind of sponsor are you going to have? Is it going to be male or female? Or they're telling them what bathrooms to use. That's not what AA is. AA helps the alcoholic in need. And I got with the conference. I got to read like 27 different letters, and I got to see the experience. And all 134 voting members voted unanimously to update the pamphlet. And I just felt like AA was so inclusive that day, and I was so happy to be a part of it. And I remember when I moved to Connecticut, here's the importance of a GSR. I'm sorry, I'm shoving one more story in there. We went to a Big Book meeting, and there was a Spanish guy that came to the group. And although I grew up with a lot of Spanish-speaking Latinos in my neighborhood, I didn't speak Spanish. So we got him a Spanish Big Book, but we realized, what's the point? He doesn't know what we're saying. So I connected the local Spanish district, and we started a Spanish meeting. It was called Mi Esperanza en Danbury, which is My Hope in Danbury. And we created this meeting, and Miguel was on a church stoop drunk again. And this meeting only lasted a year because people were traveling from all over the state. They couldn't sustain that. What we found out when that meeting died was there already was a Spanish meeting. But because they didn't have a GSR, nobody knew about it. So a GSR is about a lot more than listening to lectures and picking up flyers. It's the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous. It saves lives. I'm going to end with this one, and I'll make it quick. And sure, I told it last time when Dave was there, but I was at the International Convention of Young People in AA in San Antonio. I was speaking on a panel. I was outside the meeting smoking a cigar with some friends from Jersey. And there were six or seven people in the atrium. And I knew there were six or seven people because I was resentful at them. And I call this the story of hope. And I ask you to decide which Alcoholics Anonymous do you want to be a part of? Because this is what this lesson is for me. These six or seven people were standing outside, and this dog walked up. This dog, you could see its rib cage. It was dehydrated. It had mange. It had scabies. It was on its way. It was on death's door. These 67 people were just patting its head and saying, oh, it's so cute. Look at the puppy. So cute. Look at the puppy. They weren't doing anything for it. It was dying right in front of them. They were doing nothing for it. Taxi pulled up. Dog ran off. I went and caught the dog, brought it to the hotel room, gave it cold cuts and water. AA has gave me relationships all over the country. So I knew a guy in San Antonio. He hooked me up with a clinic. Two other people I knew drove me to the clinic. There was a woman in the waiting room. I had no idea that knew my other friend. All these things, all these events started to come together. I started to name this dog Hope in the back of my mind. The vet said that this dog's 6 months old and it's very close to death. All of a sudden, AA members are coming to support emotionally, financially. We're giving rides. We're doing everything we can to save this dog. We end up saving the dog's life. It ended up needing long-term treatment, which a bunch of us paid for. And that dog's in the next room. That dog is still with me 8 years later. And that's the story of Hope. And every time I see that dog, it reminds me of what Alcoholics Anonymous did for me. Thank God there weren't six or seven people standing outside watching me die and doing nothing. But I had the people that were willing to take my hand and show me the way. The people that, you know, were involved in service, were involved in carrying the message. Thanks for having me tonight, guys. Appreciate it.
Ah, thank you so much, Craig. That was fire. I'm going to allow everybody to unmute themselves and thank Craig.
Thank you, Craig.
Thanks, Craig. That was awesome. Thank you so much, Craig. Thank you. Thanks, Craig. I learned so much tonight. I learned so much. Thank you.
Love Sandy Hook.
Thank you, Craig. That was solid, man.
All right, I'm going to take it back and give Craig a break for a minute or two while we do some announcements and things like that. I'm going to mention again that Larry is the user questions. If you have any questions for Craig, we'll get to that in a moment. But please, 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 please send some questions to the user questions. All right, the self-support card says that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential. At every level of AA service, it is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remains self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I will take a couple of announcements for the good of AA by show of green hand. Ebony.
Hey all, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. The Candlelight in Norfolk District 14 are hosting a workshop. It is Bill Wilson's Spiritual Journey from 1955 to 1970. We were trying to work in sex and relationships into the title as well, because, you know, that always sparks up some interest. It's August 28th at 8 p.m. for about 30 minutes. JS from LA will be talking about some of the history, and then we'll follow that up with some question and answers. Once again, that's August 28th at 8 p.m. Candlelight meeting. You can find the flyer and the info on tidewaterintergroup.org, or I'm sure someone can put the flyer in the group chat. Thanks.
Thanks, Ebony. KP.
Hi, I'm Vince. I'm an alcoholic. Am I unmuted?
Yeah, you're unmuted.
Go, Vince. Go, man. Cadence, baby. Come on.
And I know that I was announcing Wakefield Camp for our conference this happening. We had a committee meeting today, and well, it's not happening. So also, Craig, you did a great job. I saw you in San Antonio and killed it then and killed it tonight. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Vince. All right, any other announcements for the good of AA? All right. Tomorrow night, Simple Actions will be meeting. We have Eric M and Sammy G on steps 8 and 9 Monday night. And next week at this meeting, the Sunday night speaker meeting, we have Katie Parker from Austin, Texas. Looking forward to that. And let's see, we're getting some questions in. Keep them coming. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you to not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we'll be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. The Simple Actions Group is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or are in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Yay. Love you guys. BJ raised her hand. Let's see. I think that's about it for that. And good. We got some questions here. Craig, thank you so much. That was amazing. We've got several questions here. I'm just going to read them as they come in. During this time, how do you continue to engage in service work to carry the message to new prospects? Well, so that's sort of a two-part question. I assume we're talking about the pandemic, and we're talking about service work and also 12-step work.
Yep, thanks for the question. So, AA still needs to survive. I mean, if it wasn't for intergroup posting up all these meetings initially when the pandemic hit, that's where it initially came from. A lot of these things wouldn't exist, and then our local structure. So as a past delegate, I mean, it's kind of easy to be honest, because a lot of folks ask me to do workshops on this, workshops on that. But just, I mean, staying involved with the committee, I serve on a corrections committee, and we try to get digital meetings into the federal prison and the state prison. And I work with folks in the area on the service level. And, you know, you still have the district meetings, and you find ways. Like right now, it's a great time to contact teachers and professionals if you're doing PI or CPC, because people are working from home and you have a Zoom format. So there's actually in some ways more opportunities for service than there was before. As far as carrying the message, you know, I know what it says in tradition 4 of language of the heart. There's a line there that talks about, like, basically we meet them where they're at, or maybe I'm misquoting, but anyways, and I meet them where they're at. So if they're at Zoom, then we meet them on Zoom, you know, and I raise my hand, I communicate, I show up, and I try to work with them. We're taking things pretty serious. I mean, we read the safety card. So, I mean, I think safety applies during a pandemic too. So if members are feeling unsafe going to in-person meetings, then we make Zoom available. I guess in short, I'm not doing anything different. I'm willing and able to serve. I'm getting my hands up. I'm showing up. I'm communicating. So I hope that answered the question.
Thank you. The next question is, have you ever had a resentment toward a sponsor? Have you ever had a sponsee with a resentment toward you? And what did you do about those situations?
Well, I had a resentment at every sponsor I've ever had. And what I did was I made amends after I looked at my side of the street. In most cases, it was me judging them or me expecting or demanding more than my fair share. There was one sponsor I had who I actually found drunk right before I was about to do a fifth step with him. His girlfriend came running down the stairs saying, "You do not want to deal with this guy. He's a nut." And I was like, "Whoa, this is very uncomfortable." And I spent my last couple of dollars buying him soup at the diner, because that man, even up until the point he drank, gave me so much of his time and gave me so much of his experience. And I'm no different than him. Sponsees, I tell them all the time, open communication. If you have a resentment, let's talk about it. I came from an alcoholic home with no communication. I love communication. I can take it and I can give it. So if they have something going on with me, I want to hear it. And if I need to own something, I will. But also if they need to own something, I'll let them know. But I'm glad somebody asked this, because I said it earlier in the talk, but I want to make, we are supposed to be equals. We're supposed to be shoulder to shoulder. If I'm a sponsor and I can't admit I'm wrong to my sponsee, there's a problem there. What message am I really carrying? You know, so that's what I did with it. I did the steps.
You know, I don't know if this dovetails with this question, but my ears kind of perked up at a point you made during your talk as well about sort of how we carry ourselves and the idea that the person on their way out the door is not going to tell you why they're going out the door. They just go. I don't know. Is there any more to share on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think if I'm living in the 11th step and I know my purpose, and whether it's at a Zoom meeting or a in-person meeting, I'm paying attention. I'll give you an example. I was at a small meeting in England. I now sponsor two different men from two different parts of the UK. And one of them, this is a true story. I was at their, what is a 2 p.m. meeting for me, a 7 p.m. meeting for them. And I noticed this one individual, I won't say his name, but I noticed this individual, and he always looked uncomfortable. Like I could just tell, even though it's Zoom, because I know what uncomfortable is. And I reached out to him and I asked if he wanted to talk. And it turns out this man is 13 years sober and on his way out, very close to a drink. And now we're going through the book and working the steps. And guess what? I'll give credit to the source. He said the most wonderful thing. We did some book work Friday morning. He said the most wonderful thing to me about why he likes Zoom. He says all the boxes are the same size. And that's the perfect illustration of what AA is. We're all the same. You know, yeah, some of us have a little more experience. Yeah. And I'll probably ask you for something and you'll ask me for something, but we're all the same here.
Beautiful. Why is a service sponsor necessary? Why do you need a separate sponsor for service? Do you think a 12-step sponsor can also be a service sponsor? Can you describe the benefit of having two different sponsors?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because every time when I share that, I want to explain the whole thing, but then it would take up half my story. So I'm glad somebody gave me the venue to do that. So here's the thing. Most of the people I sponsor, I'm their sponsor and service sponsor. I chose to have a different sponsor for my service sponsor. I'm also very fortunate. When I served as delegate, my service sponsor was trustee and my sponsor was delegate. So I got to serve with both of them at the conference, which is just awesome. But anyways, if somebody's brand new to Alcoholics Anonymous and they just get to the steps and they haven't even gotten to the traditions and concepts yet, they're not really qualified to be a service sponsor. So I'm okay with the principle of a sponsor taking you through everything, but I'm also okay with the idea that you get to pick and choose. Do you have a sponsor? Do you have a service sponsor? And any variation in between. Some people use the words mentor. I think the point for me is to understand that I need help and I need to be able to communicate my step work and my service work. And I also need to give that. Benefits, I mean, I don't know. At the same time, I'm no longer calling different people up to get the answer I want. I'm actually calling the people up that want to challenge me. So I also have a network of people. And some of those network are my sponsees, mind you. I told you I like long-term relationships. There are some people I've sponsored for almost 15 years. We're friends now. I mean, I was the best man at the wedding. I know their family. I know their wife. Actually, funny thing, it just cut me off. I'm going on a tangent. There's a couple of guys I sponsor, and my wife sponsors their wives in Al-Anon. It's just kind of a cool little, you know, it's just kind of, but anyways, you know, the benefit is having an open and honest relationship and finding the most effective way to carry the message, in my opinion.
Right on. Are there things about AA that you've seen over the years that you wish we still did, or things you wish we didn't do anymore?
Can you say that one more time?
It's sort of a recurrent question, and it seems to come up like it seems to have to do with changes in AA over the years. Somebody phrased it, have you seen things that have changed for the better in AA over the years, or things that have changed for the worse? That's sort of the spirit of the question, but I'll read it again. Are there things about AA that you've seen over the years that you wish we still did, or things you wish we didn't do anymore?
That's a trick question, because I'll try to keep it simple. So, I mean, you know, a lot of people quote the first 100 and they talk about like how great they were and how wonderful they were in the first 100, and they did their steps right away and this and that. But if you know the history, even if you just look at the preface of the big book, most of them, half of them didn't get sober. They eventually came back and some more of them got sober. But so through the course of history that I read, and through 22 years in AA, I have seen a lot of good and a lot of bad. One thing I really miss is I remember being a member of a home group where we would have like five different people standing for GSR. And if you didn't get elected, you were really upset. You were willing to be the alternate GSR or the chairperson. And we would go on Friday night, I'm not kidding you, 30 men. Now, you can't even bring that many people into a detox anymore since 9/11. But we would have 30 men go into a treatment facility and carry the message and then go to the diner. And we were going out speaking commitments, and we'd have a whole bunch of people in the car, and we'd have our own meeting before we went to the center. And I was just, I'm not going to say, you know, what's wrong and what's right, but I definitely miss that. I feel like there's a little bit more apathy these days than there was before. But I'll also acknowledge, as far as the pendulum, I know there's people that are sober longer than me that say the same thing. In human condition, we say that in generations. Now, to just answer the question simply, something that I like that AA changed was in 2015, I'm sure everybody reads Concept 11 regularly, and I'm sure everybody knows about the last two paragraphs of Concept 11, but it was very strong and offensive words to women, and we actually removed those words. So I thought that was good. That was something that I really liked that we did in AA. Something that I didn't like that we did in AA, I guess I would say, is how we dealt with the manuscript a couple of years ago.
Is there such a thing as too many sponsees, Craig?
Wow. It's funny because I did a public information thing at the school before COVID. And it's the only time in AA, and listen, I'm not going to say I'm a liar, but it's the only time at an AA meeting that I lied. They asked me, how many people did you sponsor? And I didn't want to tell them how many I sponsored because I thought it would make us all look silly. And the truth is, I'm not even going to tell you how much I sponsored, but here's my understanding. I have one less than I need. I'm willing to make the time, and my family's willing to support that. And if somebody wants to say I don't have a life, or I do have a life, or what's right, what's wrong, all I know is I'm willing to do God's work. My family supports it. I'm fortunate enough to give. And that's how I feel. So I guess the answer is you can sponsor as many people as you like and as few as you like. The only thing I would say is you definitely don't want to make it about you. You want to make sure you have the time to give the appropriate amount to each person. And the 11th step, in my experience, will show you how to do that.
Right on. You mentioned that you're more desperate every day since the day you came in the rooms. What exactly do you mean, and how do you keep that growing desperation?
The 11th step. I mean, the more, obviously, I'm not robbing safes anymore. I'm not getting into fights. I'm not, you know, cursing my mother down the stairs. But like the thinking, the more I look at my selfishness and my motives and dishonesty, the more I need God, the more, thank God, I have this thing. And that's what I mean. The more I work this program, the more the veil is pulled from my eyes, and the more I realize how much it's been God's grace. Like, there's times I'll say to myself, man, I worked hard. I did this. And then I look, and it's like, if it wasn't for all of you and if it wasn't for the program, I mean, forget about it. So I get desperate the more I work the steps.
Someone writes, how do you talk to loved ones about Al-Anon?
Same way I talk to the people I hate. I mean, I just basically share my experience, strength, and hope with them. And I just put principles before personalities. I mean, truth is, I've 12-stepped my whole family in this house, my stepson, my wife, and my mom. And I think what's good is I include, like I was trying to say when I was sharing my story, like, we're nowhere to be found. We're out there drinking, and then we come to AA, and we're still nowhere to be found. So when there's an anniversary meeting, I invite them. If there's an Al-Anon meeting that I really like, I invite them. I say, hey, mom, you know what? I'm going to this Al-Anon anniversary, or I'm going to this Al-Anon convention. I'd really like some company. Are you willing to come? You know, so you find creative ways. I can't answer these questions for you specifically, but by using the 11th step, I find creative ways. Like, I know my mom today because I'm paying attention, so I know ways that I can connect with her. I also know Matt's mom, and I also know how Matt's mom is, so I know ways that I can connect with her. But the bottom line is, if you don't have it, you can't give it. And if you work on it, you'll find a way. I mean, the success rate, it's not my success rate, but AA's success rate is so high when we use it, you know?
Yeah. If you see someone leave a meeting looking uncomfortable to you, do you follow them out or do you let them go?
I mean, I would need a more specific example. Like, I mean, and plus uncomfortable. I mean, you know, after room's uncomfortable, but I mean, it's like, I'm going to try to answer this question. When it comes to sponsorship, I don't chase people. If you want help, I'm here for you. But I'm also not a sponsor that doesn't call you. If you ask my guys, even as many as I sponsor, I'm calling them, I'm checking on them. So to keep the question simple, if it's a new person, new to the meeting, newcomer, something's going on, I don't know them, something looks really strange, yes, I go out and I say, hey, man, I'm Craig, what's going on? Want a cup of coffee, anything I can do, you know, whatever. We find a creative way. But if it's Johnny, who I've known for 20 years, and he's kind of upset because he hasn't worked a 10-step in 20 years, and he wants the treasury to be 500 instead of 400, and he leaves the business meeting because nobody listens to him, I kind of let him go. And then I send him a text the next day and say, hey, John, man, I missed you. I hope you're doing well. That's kind of how I would handle something.
Right on. Are step 6 and 7 really as simple as the big book says?
Well, for me, as I tried to share, this is a great question. I remember when I was in South Florida, I was on my second or third step, and all of a sudden I was feeling myself. I had some muscles, a little tan. I got a job, all this kind of stuff. The beach was beautiful. You know, I could breathe again. And I wanted to be a speaker. I wanted to speak everywhere. Somebody made the mistake of letting me share my story at a 250-person meeting when I didn't even have experience. I don't know what they were thinking. So I don't even know what the heck I said. But from that speaking commitment, some other sick person thought I had something to offer, and they said, why don't you come share on 6-step? And I couldn't wait to share on the 6-step. I invited all my friends to come, and I went to go share, and literally I froze. I had nothing to offer. I had no idea what the 6-step was. The reason I'm illustrating this is, but when I had a proper sponsor guide me, and I went through those first 5 steps, and the 6th step and the 7th step was, 6 steps, an affirmation. You understand what these defects are. You just saw them and all that work. Are you willing to let go of them now? And if you are, let's say a 7th step prayer, which is just asking God to prepare you to make amends. So to me, they are that simple, but I only understand that because of all the work I did prior. Now, I just want to be clear. If you don't agree with that perception, I'm not saying you're off or they're not simple for you. I'm just saying for me, when I did those first 5, 6 and 7 were very simple. Before I did those first 5, I couldn't explain 6 to you if I tried.
Ah, right on. Again, it's been a rapid hour and a half. I've got I got one more question, and then we'll close it down. Anything that you would care about to share about the value of being a home group member, or what a home group's been for your recovery?
Yeah, I would. So as I shared with you, the ability to be of service kept me out of myself, gave me a place to come every week. To be able to have camaraderie with people was so important because, like I said, I grew up, my first real family, even though I have a good family today, my first real family was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in here so broke, and I'm not saying there was nobody in my family around, but there was no real relationship there. So to be able to meet, I mean, I've been a part of groups that has 23 meetings, and I've also been a part of groups that has 1 meeting, but to be able to show up to the business meeting and participate in a worldwide organization and to figure out how I can contribute on that level, to do something as small as greeting or making coffee, even though it is large, to represent my group as a GSR, to be a part of the meeting, to help set up, break down. I mean, that's the bloodline of AA. I mean, at the end of the day, everybody that gets sober because they came to a home group. People that become trustees and delegates and GSRs and DCMs and young people's convention chairs, they all come from a home group. And I'll tell you one more that's even more important. If you're an open meeting, you have nursing students and doctors coming to your meeting, whether you realize it or not. So I would encourage you to take a group conscience and be prepared and have packets for them, and maybe even make an announcement that this is an open meeting. If you are a visitor, please see Joe or see John or see Debbie. They'll get you a packet so we can tell you what A is and what it isn't. And I would have some bylaws and guidelines to make sure we're specific. And here's why. I don't want to debate, is the old timer more important than the newcomer or this or that? But here's what I know. A doctor or a nursing student is potentially going to see 5,000 to 10,000 alcoholics in their career. You want them to have a good taste in their mouth. You want them to send them to your group, because if you don't have AA members, if you don't have alcoholics coming to your meeting, you're not going to survive. So I think there's nothing more important than a home group. And I think it's so important for me to be willing to give. If I was a member of your group, there's one time you won't like me, and it's at the business meeting. If you're not willing to participate in service at the group, you're not going to like me. I'm never going to say anything directly to you because I don't know what's going on in your life. Maybe you can't do something right now. And I'm not going to be arrogant enough to say, but I am going to challenge the group. And I am going to say, what are we doing here? Do we need a group inventory? Why are we having a hard time fulfilling basic positions here? You know what I mean? Sorry, went off on a tangent there.
Oh, no. No, beat that drum all day. Oh, thank you so much. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Amy, I wonder if I could ask you, please, to read a vision for you.
I'd be happy to. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Amy. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Larry, for wrangling the questions. Thank everyone who participated. Craig, that was amazing. Let's all circle up virtually and hold hands virtually. And we'll close with the Lord's Prayer, and then everyone is able to be unmuted and thank Craig one more time. So let's just have a moment of silence to do with as you wish. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.